Hi, and I'm Lee Maxey, and this is another of the Mind Maxing podcast series. And I'm delighted to be here with George Irvine, who's I've known for over a decade, and he's been very active and a wonderful leader in the higher education space, and looking beyond just what I'd call college age students. Mind Max podcast, this series is on adolescence to adulthood and the many pathways and journeys that people take towards what I'd call becoming a successful and functioning adult, and how education can either help and or hinder that process or that journey as they move from adolescence to adulthood. So welcome, George, and I'd like to start with a positive, which is, you know, what in your mind is working currently with the educational support of an adolescent as they move towards adulthood?
Yeah, that's a great question, Lee. And thanks so much, first off, for having me on the podcast. I'm excited to share whatever insights I have. And then, of course, check out the other podcasts to learn from my peers, because I'm sure they've got some good insights as well. So my 18-year-old calls this adulting. And sometimes that's a bad word, like, oh, dad, you're adulting. You don't adulting me, or don't adult me. And then in other cases, it's a good thing. Like, oh, I'm learning these skills of adulthood as he transitions and views his transition into college. And this is pretty exciting because it got me thinking, like, what does that verb even mean? Because, you know, we all want to be kids. Keep the youthful mindset as we go through and be learners throughout our life. But I think obviously one of the key things for adulting and successful adulting is education. You know, education comes in multiple forms, like education about yourself and your interests and your stress behaviors, what makes you happy, what makes you sad, what you're interested in, right? And that's kind of like this self-awareness, which comes around, I don't know, for men, apparently it comes later than for women. At least that's what my older sister used to tell me. So I would think education about the self and your self-interest is the first key step. So how do we do that in higher ed? Well, so the trend I'm seeing is like you teach not just what you're going to teach when they get to college or a community college, but you also teach them how to learn and how to navigate the experience. So it's what you call student services, or it's what you call advising. This is taking place now via text, like coaches send text to people, to students. I just like, first of all, texting didn't exist when I was a freshman, but had I had it, you know, maybe I would have gotten more assignments in on time or done better on certain tests. So I can see the merits of that. But so it's not just teaching them, it's also giving them the support infrastructure that helps in that process of like becoming self-aware, knowing what they're interested in, and then navigating the process to successful completion of whatever, you know, education thing they're looking to achieve, let it be a degree or a course or a pre or post baccalaureate certificate. So education, you know, starting with the self and then learning something, let it be a discipline or interdisciplinary thinking, which will help them land the job. That's one way. That's the instrumental way of thinking, like, will they get the job? Will our employers be able to hire people who are skilled, who can advance whatever it is that they're making? The other way of thinking is that they'll be happy. They can learn some stuff, self-realize as an individual, and be happy and productive citizens. That's really the true huge benefit from a social perspective. Mm-hmm. So you can see what I just did there, Lee. I went from the individual to the institution and process of higher education to the societal benefits. So that's how I got to thinking about what is adulting. Now, are there good parts of that process and there bad parts? But that's my initial take on it.
First of all, my apologies for not introducing you properly. So George is the Associate Vice Provost for Professional and Continuing Studies at the University of Delaware. So I apologize for not introducing you properly. I'm familiar with the term adulting because our daughter, as freshman in college, came back and said all of her friends are talking about, well, we're doing adulting now. And we went shopping and we practiced adulting and we bought groceries and we cooked a meal. And they talked about it in a very, they were very attracted to the concept, pretending like they're grown up or trying on being grown up. And one of the things that she said is they should have classes in adulting. And we could really benefit from that. And I've known that for years, whether it's, you know, how to fill out your taxes, whether it used to be when you balanced a checkbook and didn't have all those apps that did it for you. But, you know, the idea of creating a budget, it's 4 years now, and we're still working with our daughter on, you know, she's graduating this year, and she's going to need to know how to budget and live within her means. So,
yeah. That's a really good point. I mean, my big like moment of adulting is when I was registered for the draft, Selective Service. That was the moment where I said, I'm not a kid anymore if the government thinks I can carry a gun. And I dropped that piece of paper in there.
Mm-hmm. As they say, this stuff gets pretty real, pretty fast. Right, exactly. Right. I thought about it in registering to vote too. Same kind of thing. That's a really, really good point.
And that's where it kind of hit home to me. The other stuff I just learned along the way. So when I reflect, but the level of complexities now are different. You know, there's the social media complexity, the access of technology, which is both a great thing for adolescents, but it's also can be an overwhelming thing. Like, oh my God, this connects me to so much knowledge, so many people. How do I present myself at a time when that self is forming? I think can be a little overwhelming. So yeah, we're having to recognize this in higher ed because it comes down to this notion of preparedness. Are the high school kids who are coming to us prepared? And you can measure that multiple ways, like academically prepared on test scores that might drop over time or rise over time, like placement test scores of freshman class, or you can look at it like the other things that they used to call co-curricular when in fact are co-life. Mm-hmm. Those are the life skills that help mm-hmm. students succeed and then graduation rates succeed. And that's, you know, how higher ed is measured in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. So that, I mean, people are not the same, and the different kinds of experiences they bring in terms of different levels or types of readiness as they come to an institution. And then, you know, they have different experiences at the institution. So can you talk about that fragmented or that, I'll call it diverse sort of set of pathways that are necessary for someone to be successful and how you see higher ed either dealing with that or not dealing with that?
Yeah, fragmented is a good way of thinking of it. If you take the position that higher education's form that we've assumed was normal for the past 70 years, really from the end of the Second World War up to the present, as something that we should keep, that is the 2-year, 4-year degree, that people should go get a degree out of high school. The expectation is if you go to college, you'll be better off. What's been happening over the last decade, but certainly over the last 2 years because of the pandemic, is that that model is being challenged on cost reasons. It costs too much to go to college. On outcomes reasons, well, shoot, if I take the Google certificate, they'll give me a job in data analytics. Why do I even need to go to college? Employers are now questioning the value of a 4-year degree. And then a 2-year and 4-year, those are big chunks of time. You know, and what if you just broke up the knowledge into a way that a student coming in could say, I'm going to take a little bit of this and then stack a little bit of that and then add a little bit of this. And then it might lead to a degree, or I might take a step away and be happy with what I got for the moment. And that happiness might mean they got enough skills to get a job in the industry that they're interested in. So on one level, it's fragmentation. On the other level, it's choice. And this is where I think it's exciting in higher ed, is that we're actually rethinking, well, how do we convey our important knowledge? How do we convey it? And how long does it need to be? And can it be shorter, more affordable, stackable? And I think that's really exciting because it's like building a new model. It's also a little scary because our cost structure is built on that old 2- and 4-year model and the government money. But here it's like, wait a minute, if people don't want to buy that and our cost structure is built on that, how do we then become more efficient in the delivery of smaller chunks of knowledge? And that, you know, they take different forms. Alternative credentials, mm-hmm. stackable badges, digital badges, certificates, credit-bearing, non-credit-bearing, all this nomenclature is basically saying you don't need a 4-year period of time. you can make it shorter, and you can make it more accessible, and you can make it stackable, and you can make it digital. Now we're going through all of that,
which makes it portable, right? Right.
Yeah. Right. And we're doing that all at once. You know, that's the thing which is so amazing about this pandemic is that it's forcing this change to happen. And some institutions have embraced it. Some are still kind of like, I'll just bank on my name and I'll bank on an endowment, and I don't need to change. And they might be right, because that's the, you know, the rich kind of diversity of higher education in the United States.
Mm-hmm. So that's, I mean, that's leading me to that next question of what's a hindrance. I know as I looked at, in the 90s, the sort of talk was, that a degree is sort of a surrogate indication of someone's ability to stick with something. I heard the same thing when I became an Eagle Scout. Like that, put that on your resume, because employers will see that as someone who, during their adolescence, stuck with something for a period of time and actually finished something. And that in itself was an indicator. And we did a series of roundtables, of which I think you've got a chance to participate in. And one of the employers in these roundtables said, this was PwC, that they have a sort of a record book of rankings of colleges where they know people coming out of these schools are more likely to be successful there than not. And they, it's a confidential, but it's based on track record.
Yeah.
And it's based on these people come in, they flame out, or these people come in and they succeed. And so they've very similar to college admissions, in terms of how college admissions does that with certain high schools that are feeders or common feeders for school. I know admissions offices have the same kind of sort of track record of, someone coming from this school, generally does well. And someone from this school, either we don't have any data on it, or, they may be third in their class, but, we haven't had a lot of success with students coming from this high school. So with that, that you mentioned the digital credentials and Credly's, purchase by Pearson's recent and these micro credentials. Where do you see it going for, the portability of that is very exciting, but where do you see that going in relationship to the horse pill of a 4-year degree, which, like you said, is a giant commitment to do sort of all at once? And how do you see that flexibility or agility happening in this very structured, siloed model?
Well, I think it's going to be a both and proposition, not an either or. We've done thinking at the University of Delaware, and there still will be that undergraduate population that wants the 4-year experience, both for social reasons, personal growth reasons, educational reasons, or they just like the idea of college. And some may take 6 years. So that's what the data shows. But we also know that we're missing out on those students who might say, well, do I really need a college degree if I want to study cybersecurity, when there are these other alternative credentials that might get them into that profession quicker, more quickly, without debt? And actually, I'd like to honor that by building pathways for them to say, this is where I want to go. Would they be as fulfilled over time in the adulting conversation? Like, would they become the full adults they could be without a bachelor's degree? I have my opinions of that, but I'd like to give the students the chance to choose which path is right for them. My hunch is that from a societal perspective, the more time you have education and the chance to be educated, the greater the outcome for citizenship, for involvement, for arts, for culture, for innovation, for entrepreneurship. But it costs a lot of money. A lot of students are in a ton of debt and their families can't afford it. So higher ed better have those alternative pathways. And those pathways are tricky. So a non-credit, how do you give credit for a non-credit? Well, we still have problems with that at my university. And I know other universities do too. And that's kind of crazy. It's like, well, we develop both. Can't we just figure out what portion of this equals that? So we're in the midst of doing that. So the prior learning assessment policy review is so critical. Mm-hmm. And then if you took a bunch of little bits of knowledge and you stack them up, at what point is there an exit ramp from that pathway into a degree? Because we need to build those in too. So the students have a choice of like, you know, this is really, I started this journey to get me a job. But along the way, something happened and my brain is firing away that I wasn't anticipating. And it's made me excited about, physics, computer science, art history. There's got to be a pathway. So we can't have these parallel tracks of like alternative credentials, stackable, that's over here, degree is over here. It has to be like a threaded opportunity. What does that mean for universities? All of our measures and institutional frameworks are about attracting and retaining and graduating on this one traditional track. We're going to have to get used to like more osmosis or defections or people coming on for a little bit and then leaving and then coming back for a little bit and then leaving. Mm-hmm. That's going to be a big headache, Lee, because our structures are not built. They didn't have to be built for the past like 70 years. We didn't have to do this. Now we're having to diversify it and to do it digitally, right? So those pathways can occur and the learning can occur entirely online, but then they could go to an in-person modality and then they could jump back to online if they wanted to. And that's what they expect. The generation coming up who's going through the adulting now, they totally think it's normal to learn online. They may not like it fully or they love it, but it's like a bell curve when we've asked our students. It's right in the middle. Is about 50% want at least one of their courses online. These are traditional undergraduate students, mm-hmm. not to mention the non-traditional ones who are working and they're like, I can't take your classes unless they're online because I got kids and I got family and I got job. So that's a long way of saying it's going to be a both and proposition instead of an either or going forward. I think for those institutions that can successfully handle the pressures that we're being battered with right now.
So in the 80s and 90s, I studied and practiced a lot of instructional design, building CD-ROM-based training, actually, for companies. And two of the core principles were for adult learners to give them the ability to have a lot of choice around direction and a lot of choice around pace. Those were two very important principles from an instructional design standpoint. And that is not how I've experienced college. That's not how I see baccalaureates being set up. Our kids are in that mix right now. And for the most part, it's not lockstep. There are a lot of choices, but it's not as flexible as you're talking about. And then MindMax right now is working with several schools with their stop out population, mm-hmm. helping them to achieve their goal of a degree, even though they've gotten very close to the end line, but then for a variety of reasons have stopped out. And some of those are heart-wrenching stories. But in almost all cases, the lack of flexibility of the institution is a huge contributor to them stopping out. And that's something that I've often said the credit hour is our unfortunate unit of trade. Because that's the coin of the realm. That's what gets you federal, Title mm-hmm. IV, funding. That's the unit of trade. And it's even misnamed as far as I'm concerned, because it's about competency. It's about what can you do as a result of this tremendously valuable experience. But we're measuring it in hours, not in actually what you're able to accomplish, which is what you were talking about with some of those certificates or those smaller credentials, which almost all digital badging is a result of demonstrating an ability to accomplish something or creating some kind of work product.
I totally agree with you, because we've gone through an interesting process over the last 6 months at the University of Delaware, and I really wanted to get a digital badging platform. So working with IT and other stakeholders on campus, we put together a group, like, what do we need? What do we want? How are we going to use it? And we came up with answers. But then we had to go through Faculty Senate. And it came really down to some interesting pedagogical questions about what constitutes knowledge gains and how do we measure them? I don't know if it was clever or not, but we just said, look, we're going to use digital badges for non-credit. We're not going to try to put them into the credit world. And that was a way of taking a small step. And Faculty Senate said, yeah, this is a good idea. Go forth. So we're piloting that this semester and we'll expand it further. But some of the first questions I got from faculty in sessions that I held, to get feedback was, well, why can't I use it in a credit course, George? I was like, well, there is conceptually no reason against that. But for reasons of launching this, we're going to start non-credit. But those faculty members totally got that you could embed badges, digital badges for knowledge gains in a three-credit course because they've already set up their syllabi. Like by the end of this course, student will know how to do this and will know these skills. And each of those conceptual abilities or skill gains could be badged. Now that is going to be really exciting, I think. So when I've looked at, you know, Accredible and Credly and Badger and other potential platforms, I didn't realize it was as good as it is. It's a really robust platform. It's going to change the way we port or carry our knowledge and demonstrate our knowledge. And its registrars are now wrestling with, like, wait a minute, a badge is essentially the same thing in some ways as a diploma or, you know, or a course of study, an official kind of registrar piece of paper. And I know our registrar is like, wait, I'm looking ahead here. And if this takes off, this is something that you have to track. And that's where I'm encouraged that there's actually openness for these types of initiatives at my university. And I know others like Rutgers is ahead of us and some others have already been badging. But so the concern you've stated, like, hey, higher ed isn't getting it. I think we are getting it. It's just the rate of getting it varies and the destabilization it presents to institutional will vary by that university, by their context, by what their students want to. Because our students were saying, can I get a badge? Our non-credit students. And we're like, yeah, we looked at that 2 years ago, but we haven't done anything. We should do that. So it's the customer driving this, really.
Yeah. I mean, a 4-year sheepskin could include underneath it 100 badges.
Yeah. And it's,
you know,
and
instead of a single credential, 100 micro credentials.
And they're on my phone and I'm going to share them in social media land and I'm going to tell my friends about them. And then
as appropriate.
Yeah. You know? And their friends who are going through the adulting process or whatever, you know, can say, oh, that badge looks really interesting. Click, click. I'm going to take that, especially if it's digital. That's one way to address my concern about, like, if our universities are set up to deliver 2- and 4-year programs and we expect X amount of revenue to cover Y amount of costs to keep this place going, the only way a non-credit alternative credential badge will work if your price has to be really low is if you go in volume or you go it as a complement to, you know, add value to the 2- and 4-year degree. So that's what I'm learning. And I'm like, oh, okay, this is doable. This is a both and proposition. We don't have to look at these as a threat as much as a way to add value to what we bring. Through, you know, this is the thing that I've been thinking about too. And I'm going to jump ahead a little bit, I suppose. But, you know, what is higher ed's differentiator? Because I can jump on LinkedIn Learning. My university just bought it and gave it to us. I'm like, oh, go learn. I was like, guys, you're taking business away from my non-credit team by giving me, but I jumped on LinkedIn Learning. It's actually really good. I like it. But it's building block knowledge. There's no applied knowledge. It doesn't help the student figure out, how do I apply this in my business, in my life, or in my organization? So what does a university bring is that, let's talk about what you learned and apply it and test you and give you situations. And then you can talk about with your fellow students. And guess what? We can throw this research that we did on this very topic. Now, that's, I think, our differentiator in higher ed, which LinkedIn Learning can't touch. They can beat us on scale. They can beat us on digitization. But they can't beat us on that applied knowledge piece yet. Maybe artificial intelligence in the future will do that, but not yet. So I think that's actually something for us to hang our hats on in higher ed.
And that may change the instructor population or how you source your instructor population to have more practical, you know, experienced people. I think one of the things that just, you know, I have to work with PeopleSoft and Banner and all those incredibly inflexible, in my opinion, inflexible systems. And I'm just, you know, my head's exploding thinking of how difficult it is for, you know, just to do instead of 3 starts a year or 4 starts a year, doing rolling starts, just with current situation, much less throw in these sort of different data sets of badges. And I don't need to go there. That's a in the weeds kind of thing. But man, that's going to be special when they try and integrate a Credly platform with PeopleSoft or Banner, and then the registrar. Then how do you get funding, from the federal government, and how do you get accreditation? And, there's a lot of ramifications down the line that schools are going to have to figure out. I agree with you. I think having more exposure underneath the 4-year or 2-year degree, and connecting up to, I'll call them micro credentials for right now. I think that is a very great both and. And then how is that perpetuated with their transcript? You have two transcripts or one transcript kind of thing.
And that's why we stuck with the non-credit side because I actually think the badges are going to be really fun in going back to like the adulting and like the skills that students need to advance, not just their educational side, but their personal development side. Because you could give a badge for things like, financial competence related to your checkbook, managing your checkbook, or give a badge to some of the student service training programs that we do. And I think that's how what's going to ultimately happen is the badges will start in that way, and then at least in my university, and then kind of encroach perhaps into the credit realm. So that's a really exciting way that technology can help students, giving them more choice. And so far, structural adjustment of the university, it just takes perseverance. And for me and my team who may see it like, oh yeah, that's great, we can see how this is going. And you have to build your allies and from the more traditional ranks, talk to them. Actually, and their concerns is really valid sometimes too. Like, well, how do you know what one badge is equal to another? Well, you don't actually. There's no universal standard of, there's technical standards for badging, but what you issue one badge for is different than another. And those are real concerns. So I think you're right to point that out. But ultimately, I think it's a vehicle to help students coming to higher ed learn life skills as well as hard skills.
So what do you think are some of the things that are, I'll call it obstacles or things that are potentially hindering people from, or on their journey or in their pathways, whether it's how they discover opportunities, how they move through things, from, the 13, 14-year-old through to whenever someone's considered adult?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Structurally, I'll start with a structural impediment that I see. And that's like our higher ed institutions don't talk to each other well enough. When a student starts at one place and they can't just quickly jump to another, like the articulation agreements aren't built, even in a small state like Delaware, where you're dated or related is the saying. So we ought to get that down, right? And we're working on it, actually. I think we're working on it. So building those pathways, not just within the institution, but between the institutions. Because from the state's perspective, they put money in us. They put it in Dell Tech. They put it in Dell State. They put it in job training. They put it in workforce development boards. So from a taxpayer perspective, having that kind of synergy and pathways and interexchangeability when appropriate, someone's not going to jump from typically from a Dell Tech, or a community college training program on like wind power to advanced material science, dreaming up new materials. That is a pathway that might not make sense, but there are other pathways that you can. So if we do that, I think it's going to help the students also who right now, because I've talked to folks in Southern Delaware high schools and they're like, no, UD is not for me. University of Delaware is not for me. And I was like, why? Like, oh, it's just, I can't see myself there. And then we've done some early college dual enrollment programs. So high school kids can take our courses for free, which is very cool. Mm-hmm. We're not getting money from the state either to subsidize that. We're just saying, look, we value our knowledge and your thirst for knowledge. We're going to give you these general education courses for free. Mm-hmm. And they're doing well. Some of those students who said, oh, I can't see myself there, they're actually doing well in us, in our courses. And as a result, we're getting applications from them. Now, for me, that's like awesome because I opened up a research university for a student who didn't see themselves at a higher education institution. Oh, I only have to go to the community college, or I only have to go to job training, or I won't go to college. Mm-hmm. So that's where, you know, I think we're actually making advances to help those students when they're ready to go. The side of the question that you posed, like, well, what about like when they're 13 or 14? I don't know enough about that age. I mean, that's one. I have colleagues who've done analysis in Delaware of how do we help junior high school students study the science they need to succeed here. And it's worked. You know, we made a commitment to them saying, look, if you take these classes from eighth grade on and you show competency and good grades in those classes, you pretty much are going to get a spot here at UD. And that's really helped also build like this pipeline to, you know, in our state, like the premier research university. But how do you help the student feel confident that they can do that? That's where this collaboration between K-12 and tertiary institutions are so important on the process of adulting. The students, this complementary soft skills, which are so critical to ensure that any hard skill is mastered, you know.
Yeah, and I know the research on that is also around first gen and other vulnerable populations. It's the Pygmalion effect. I mean, it's what you believe. And, you know, the Henry Ford quote of, you know, whether you think you can or think you can't, you're going to be proven right.
I didn't know that quote. That's a good quote. Yeah, I like that.
And yeah, it's like,
so you might as well be an optimist, right?
Well, I'm definitely, you know, I'm not the glasses half full. I'm the glasses always refillable.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
how I look at it. So,
that's even better.
That first gen student or that vulnerable population, however that's determined, the expectation of going to college is sewn into the fabric of how they've their family, their culture, you know, at a very young age, not even 13 or 14, but much younger than that. So what you talked about tertiary, other kinds of supporting institutions. And one of the podcasts we'll be doing is with an entity that helps create those pathways at those younger ages and works cool. with K-12 schools to create an expectation that you not only can go to college, but you should at least consider that as a very real like future for yourself.
Yeah.
And that you can succeed. So those are exciting shifts. I think one of the challenges we have is in the, I'll call it the lexicon of our media right now about failure rates or how long it's taking people to graduate and so forth. It doesn't talk about how we went from a very small percentage of the population went to college 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And now we're saying college, we're trying to make college accessible to everyone. And that's people just are not going to have the same success rates. It's not likely to be possible. And so I think, you know, expectation setting and also providing additional services, not just around the adulting piece, but around, you know, how do you write a good research paper? To not think that they learned that in high school, and you know, our children graduated from a good high school. However, I would suggest that their writing skills could use a lot of improvement. And college isn't necessarily set up to do that. I'll call it remediation, but it's not even remediation. It's what you need, George, coming into a situation, and what I need to complement what I bring to the situation could be different. And so I'm thinking in that early stage investment around just determining who's coming. The SAT is obviously not like the be all end all. We know that. So what is it that can be done to in a sense, diagnose who I am versus who you are coming into a situation, knowing that we're different?
Yeah. Our associates and arts program directors taught me a really good way of thinking. You know, it's what does this student have, not what the student lacks. And often in admissions, we focus on what the student might lack for reasons of exclusivity or just traditional way of thinking. And the AA program is definitely like, no, what do they have and how do we meet them where they're at? to get them where they want to go. Mm-hmm. And that's a great, I love that. I'm like, what do they have? It's an assets inquiry approach. Like, what mm-hmm. asset do they have intellectually, physically, you know, personally? And how do we meet them where they're at? So that's a nice way of thinking too, particularly for first gen or non-traditional students who, because mm-hmm. when our advisors talk to them and they come to us, and some of them have been out of school for like 10 years, 15 years, and they'll say, I'm really, they're afraid that they might mm-hmm. fail. So our advisors can pick up on that. Like, they could be coming up with reasons that they're not going to matriculate into that class or take that non-credit program. And it's really fundamentally, hey, we're here for you. We designed these for you coming back to school. And let me tell you some success stories of people who were in your chair or in your screen now who have succeeded and given us their mm-hmm. success stories. And that really helps because it's the confidence of, you know, meeting them where they're at to help them in to higher ed and then to help them finish. You know, going to your point about like, should everyone, or you didn't pose it this way, but I had colleagues in Germany when I studied there pose it to me. Like, well, not everyone should go to college, George. Look at the statistics of the dropout rate. In your country, you say everyone should go to college and you push them there. And then the social, economic, and personal costs when they flunk out is high because you've sunk a lot of investment. They've sunk a lot of investment into them. So like in Germany, they're given a test at 12 or 13 and then you're tracked, you know, like trades, a skilled like accounting or university. And it's a small percentage that go to university. And I was like, well, that's deterministic. And it's like, that would never fly in the United States because your future is determined based on how you perform on a standardized test in 13. Of course, the SAT in some ways does that a little older, right? And the data is showing that to us. But then what's happened in Delaware, and it's happening in other states too, is I was at a Chamber of Commerce event or something, and they're talking about, we need to learn from Germany about their internship programs and their apprenticeship programs. And I was like, wait a minute, what are they talking about here? Are they really talking about what I think they're talking about, which is certain students at junior high and high school could be steered towards an apprenticeship program? And that's a little bit of what they're talking about. So my German colleagues from 1990, right, when I studied over there, would be saying, see, you could learn from us, you know, and our Senator Chris Coons was talking about this. And lo and behold, we're actually starting to build those. And it's benefiting students who are like, I don't need to go to UD. I'm going to learn this high-tech robotic manufacturing apprenticeship. And guess what? They're getting paid really good money. Right. And they're doing work at an Amazon fulfillment center or at a sheet metal fabrication, which is doing stuff for the space industry. That's an awesome success story, I got to say. They shouldn't come to UD if they really are happy with that. So I think some of those pathways are being built from a policy perspective based on, you know, we don't need everyone to go to college to have, for them to feel fulfilled, to feel like an adult. And, you know, those are really good jobs too. Pretty interesting stuff.
So looking forward, you've already addressed some of this in your earlier comments, but, you know, what do you see happening or what do you think needs to happen in order to, I'll just say, address, you know, the very differentiated population that's coming through their teenage years and also the longer trajectory it's taking now for people to get to that adult place?
Yeah, well, I think success stories help. So we try to talk to students about, look what the people who have been in your shoes have succeeded through whatever choice they make, right? That they're motivated, they choose a path of an educational pathway, either at UD or elsewhere, and they've are happy now or are proud of their accomplishments. So starting conversations about, you know, where do you want to go? And then how can we help you get there is, I think, really important. And that can take different structural. I won't go into that. Like, well, there's advising, there's counseling, there's, you know, it could be done electronically, it'd be done in person, all that kind of stuff. But that's a key function, I think. The other is exciting them about the possibilities. Like at the junior high level in particular, like, check this out. You know, science isn't just about memorization or just about, you know, doing well in a lab. It's about answering a question related to gravity, you know, that's, or to you know, it could be like art conservation and the chemistry behind art conservation. So that's an exciting them about knowledge acquisition and education, instead of saying, this is what you have to do to be that, right? Which is more deterministic. Mm-hmm. And honestly, it limits us, because some of the kids may have really good questions and curiosity in their head that the quote master or the professor might say, whoa, yeah, that's great, right? And that gets back to that old kind of Socratic method. So it's like success stories of where they could go, and then excite them of the questions they could seek to answer by being educated. That would be neat. I think that's really important for, you know, society. If we do that well, we'll just be, I think we'll probably be happier people, you know, yeah, instead of anxious or angry or other, you know, characteristics.
Yeah, Andy Chan, who we spoke with earlier, had an interesting, I'll call it quote, which is, you know, that people following their passions, well, if they don't know their passions yet, follow your interests to discover your passions. And yeah. I think, you know, that what you're talking about is along those lines, which is, you know, I mean, I think back to that German model, conversation, trying things out, until I had the ability to apply some of my learning to things that were important to me, it was very hard for me to be passionate about learning for learning's sake. Yeah. And I do know the applied learning for me personally has made all the difference in terms of my enthusiasm about digging into material deeper than just doing things from a compliance standpoint. And that's one of the things I struggle with the high stakes testing in K-12 is yeah. we've squeezed out a lot of the wonder uh-huh. out of the process of learning, which is sad to me. My lights keep on going off. It's nice.
Yeah, no problem. Well, and the thing about the lifelong learning, it's a good point, because my division leads the Osher Lifelong Learning Institutes mm-hmm. at the University of Delaware. And we're now the biggest online Ollie in the country because wow. of our online ability. Oh, we're able to pivot. Yeah. So we have like members in Delaware and 25 other states.
Oh, wow.
So go figure, huh? But the members of Ollie, like when I meet with them, or it's a cooperative governance model. So there's a council of members who, and I meet with them and we set the strategy and help the Ollies grow, you know, they're teaching a course on 14th century French literature, or they're teaching a course on modern politics and social media. And these are retired folks teaching each other. That is inspirational. Every time I look at that catalog, I'm like, what are you guys teaching each other? This is awesome. And they'll bring in professors and stuff, but that lifelong learning and curiosity, every time I work with our Ollies, I'm just mm-hmm. reminded it doesn't end mm-hmm. optimally. The human learns forever.
Yeah, and or can, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, George, thank you so much. Is there any closing comments or thoughts, in terms of your thoughts?
No, I appreciate the opportunity to share my thoughts on the good questions you pose, Lee, and thanks so much for the invitation.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you very much, George Irvine from University of Delaware. This has been another Mind Maxing podcast, and look forward to having you join us for other sessions in the future. If you found this podcast valuable or the topic important, please consider sharing it with your network. If you'd like to listen to or watch more podcasts or read our blog, please come to mindmax.net.